I'm gonna go to the place, the place. When they lay me down to die, I'm gonna do the spirit in the sky. Gonna do the spirit in the sky.
In the sky.
That's why I'm gonna go when I die. When I die and they lay me to rest, I'm gonna go to the place, that's the best.
The omnibus edition of My Name is Why, in which Lem Sisse, the award-winning poet, reads from his frank memoir about growing up in Britain's care system in the 70s and 80s while musing on the redemptive power of poetry. Lem begins his courageous account with his early days in foster care.
At 14, I tattooed the initials of what I thought was my name into my hand. The tattoo is still there, and it wasn't my name. I was not who I thought I was. The authority knew it, but I didn't. The authority were writing reports about me from the day I was born. My first footsteps were followed by the click-clack-clack of a typewriter. papers zipped from typewriters and into files. For 18 years, this process repeated over and over again. Click, clack, clack. The folders were taken out and placed on tables surrounded by men and women from the authority. Put him here. Move him there. Shall we try drugs? Try this? Try that? After 18 years of experimentation, the authority threw me out. It locked the doors securely behind me and hid the files in a data company called the Iron Mountain. So I wrote to the authority. Customer services replied to say they were not permitted to release the files. The authority placed me with incapable foster parents. It imprisoned me. It moved me from institution to institution. And yet now, at 18 years old, I had no history, no witnesses, no family. In 2015, following a 30-year campaign to get my records, the chief executive of Wigan Council, Donna Hall, wrote me a letter. She had them. Within a few months, I received four thick folders of documents. On reading them, I knew. I took the authority to court. Awake amongst the lost and found, the files left on the open floor, the frozen leaves on frosted ground, the frosted keys in a frozen door. 18 years of records written by strangers. All the answers to all my questions were here, possibly. And yet I feared what they'd reveal. Maybe I was loved. Maybe my mother didn't want me. Maybe it was all my fault. St. Margaret's House was an institution for unmarried mothers, affiliated to the Board of Moral Welfare. On 30th of June 1967, the state registered nurse writes that Lemmian Cisse, misspelt, was free from infectious diseases, and that the six-week-old baby weighed 9 pounds. In a letter written by Dr. Bernardo's to Norman Goldthorpe, children's officer for Wigan Authority, I'm 6 months old. At this point, my mother is invisible.
Dear Mr. Goldthorpe, further to your inquiry regarding the possibility of our adoption department being able to place a part Ethiopian, part Greek baby boy for adoption, our senior adoption officer has written to us asking that she be supplied with details of his background and whether Ethiopian means he is Negroid or not.
Then there was a photo on the back of which it says
Norman Cisse.
So my name was changed to Norman Cisse. I'm supposed to be part Greek. An adoption agency asks whether Ethiopian means he is Negroid or not. This is the first time I have seen myself referred to as Norman Cisse. In England, unmarried pregnant women were placed in mother and baby homes like St. Margaret's. Many of them didn't understand the full implication of the word adoption. They were sent home without their newborn after signing the adoption papers. My mother would not sign the adoption papers. Without my mother's signature on the adoption papers, the authority could not adopt me. So Norman Goldthorpe defied her and assigned me to long-term foster parents, Catherine and David Greenwood. My foster parents told me some years later that I was alone in the hospital because no one would adopt a coloured baby. They said they chose me after praying to God and that my mother didn't want me. My mother must have been at her most vulnerable. She was pregnant and alone in a foreign country where she'd come to study for a short period of time. I was 3.5 years old when the authority served a notice on my mother via her church in Ethiopia to say that all rights and powers of the parent of Lem Cisse be vested in the local authority, it appearing that the parent has abandoned this child. She was given 1 month to object to the notice. The notice would have taken a month to arrive in Ethiopia and another month for the letter to return. It was an impossible deadline. My story begins without her or any knowledge of her. The Greenwoods and I lived in a semi-detached house with a solid red brick gable end wall. We attended Bryn Baptist on Wednesday and Sunday. It's where our friends and family were, and we prayed. At breakfast, at lunch, at dinner. There was good and bad in the world. There was darkness and light, black and white. On 29th of May 1968, my file reports,
Norman is a healthy, contented child. The foster parents are devoted to him. He's a very affectionate child with large, appealing eyes.
Christopher, the Greenwoods' firstborn child, my little brother, came along in July. And on 15th of October 1968, it is reported,
Norman is very good with the new baby. He has got over his initial jealousy. Mrs. Greenwood is an excellent little mother.
Sarah was born 2 years after Christopher, and 8 years later came Helen. Only 14 months apart in age, Christopher and I fought like brothers. Cats and dogs had nothing on us. I adored him. When it came to the colour of my skin, my parents referred to me as chocolate. No one told me I was the same colour as Martin Luther King or Muhammad Ali. Racist comments from the outer world became more frequent. Mum and Dad's response was to tell me to ignore it, or that we are all God's children. My mum fostered a coloured baby in 1967, in a time of racial intolerance in England. Some smiled and stopped me in the pram, and others spat on the back of her coat as she walked by. Years later, they'd do the same to me. So whatever this racism was, it would be the shadow to the light of their love. I was a happy child. Mum had short black hair and dark eyes. For ages, I'd pray that she'd sit on the edge of my bed and sing me to sleep as she did when I was younger. You are my sunshine, my only sunshine. You make me happy when skies are grey. I believed her. Dad was broody, tall, witty and silent. The front room was his library. Cornerstone books for me were the Bible, the famous Five Series, and The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. I don't remember other novels or poetry except T.S. Eliot's Old Possum's Book of Practical Cats, which was my favourite. Mum and Dad said I was like McCavity. It felt affectionate then, but later I realised something wasn't right. McCavity was dark, quick, and a thief. On 11th of December 1974, the social worker wrote,
There are no problems with Norman. Mrs. Greenwood considers him as theirs. The foster parents have spoken of adoption, but they are afraid that investigations may lead to his mother. Norman is said to be exceptionally bright. He's very aware of his colour and often asks why he could not have been born to a white lady.
I was a questioner. In the Baptist church, we were taught to question why. The answer was often, because we are sinners. At school, I was subject to all kinds of questions about my race, which I couldn't answer. I brought all these questions home. She left you. She didn't want you. If I find her, I will scratch her eyes out. My mum's love was elevated by how much she hated my birth mother for leaving me. I'm 7. This is what my social worker writes.
Mr. and Mrs. Greenwood realise that there may be many problems ahead with Norman, as well as a lot of happiness.
I developed a sense that there was something wrong with me around the time I began attending junior school. My social worker reports.
After the school holidays, Christopher will be starting at the same school. And it will be interesting to see what happens, because Norman does not like Christopher to be better than him at anything.
None of what I've told you so far is true. I wasn't a happy child. I was a deceitful one. I was causing problems for everyone. It must be true.
January 1976. Spoke to Mr. Graves several times on the phone and eventually visited the school. He felt that Norman's successes were too many for his brother to cope with. Went on to talk about another placement. I put it to him that it was the only home the boy had known.
I was 9, my brother Christopher was 8. I showed my love for him by punching him. We fought with unbridled determination, the way brothers do, until one of us, invariably Christopher, would burst into tears. Catherine and David had no children when they took me. Christopher was their firstborn, but I was their first. I was the eldest. I loved my family. The head teacher suggesting to the social worker that I be moved for the sake of Christopher could not have happened in isolation. This inclines me to think my foster parents must have spoken to the head teacher. On 28th of July 1975, the social worker visited.
I called to see Norman today, the family having just returned from a holiday in Scotland. Mrs. Greenwood was upset. It seems that Norman had been getting up in the early hours and eating sweet foods, particularly biscuits, as many as 2 packets.
For the record, I did steal biscuits, but not 2 whole packs. One holiday in Scotland, at my granddad's home, the family left me in the cottage as punishment for lying about stealing some cake. I thought I'd been locked in my room, but the door was open. I sobbed my way downstairs. I saw on the table a half-cut ginger cake. The tears evaporated, replaced by butterflies in my stomach. If I cut it in exactly the same way as it was already cut, then nobody would notice that I had taken a slice. Genius! And so I did. It tasted so good. So I did it again. To this day, I don't know why I got into this habit of stealing biscuits and bits of cake, but I did. They told me I was devious. The problem was that my first instinct was to say, I didn't steal the cake. The lies worried them more than the theft. Stealing cake and lying about it was an indication that the devil was working inside of me. Within 3 years, it will be reported that I threatened to kill the entire family except for baby Helen. Look what was sown by the stars at night across the fields. I am not defined by scars, but by the incredible ability to heal. It was run by the elders, Bryn Baptist Church, a mile from our home, and a mile from Grandma and Grandad Munro. Church was full of horrific stories. People drowned in the huge flood, and Jesus stabbed with huge nails and hung on a wooden cross. Repent, repent for your sins. The temperature rose with the pastor's words. Mum threw up her arms, praise him. So I threw up mine. Was I saved by Jesus? I spent 12 years kneeling and praying, and it was the powerful rhetoric and lyricism of the church that took me to poetry. There is barely any mention of religion in my files. It wasn't discussed with a social worker.
The child has an extrovert personality and is attention-seeking. The foster parents' own children are somewhat overshadowed by this child.
Winnick was a sprawling red brick institution set in manicured greenery. Mum, me and Chris walked through the front door, and after Mum signed a register, we stepped into the wide, tiled corridor of the asylum. Our footsteps led to a big public room with lots of winged armchairs with women in them. Mum spotted one of them and stepped quietly over to her. She had an overhang to her mouth. wolf-like, hair like a nest, and she was rocking backwards and forwards. "Say hello to your auntie." "Hello, auntie." Her twisted elbow pushed out a clawed hand towards me and brushed my cheek. She couldn't speak. Mum took out a hanky and lovingly wiped drool from Auntie's mouth and chin, and I knew instinctively not to ask questions. Mum visited her twin regularly, sometimes alone, sometimes with us. My auntie had been like that from birth. My grandmother never visited her daughter with my mum and us. Did my mum blame herself? Was Catherine living with a constant sense that she was not good enough because she had taken the heir from her twin sister? She would do everything to prove otherwise. She would foster a black baby and show her mother that she was good. I saw Grandma at least once a week and I loved her. Maybe she did love Catherine, the twin that survived. But Catherine never felt it and subsequently found love difficult to give. Mum was a state-registered nurse. At the hint of a scratch or bump, she'd draw the medical kit from the top of the kitchen cabinet. I'm not sure I ever felt as close to her than when she'd say, "This is going to hurt," before dabbing my grey's knee with a pinch of cotton wool soaked in witch hazel. It's because she was a nurse that she had the comb. Each morning before school, I'd stand by the heater in the kitchen, and Mum dragged the comb through the roots until my skull felt like it had been dipped in acid. "You have hair sore," she'd say. Apparently, hair sore was a medical condition. Then, on a spring day, Mum got me up in my best shirt and trousers. I was going to meet a pop star. Errol Brown was the lead singer for Hot Chocolate. Mum took me to an apartment in Winstanley. I remember there were bowls of nuts and crisps, and it wasn't even Christmas. Errol Brown chatted to me about school. He was black, like me. I was nervous and intrigued all at the same time, and then he left the room and came back with a present for me. I stared at the strange and elegant genius of design, an afro comb. He'd been visiting a newborn child of a family friend at the hospital. Mum was the midwife on call and they must have got talking about me. Maybe she showed him the thin-toothed comb she'd been using. Maybe he winced and gritted his teeth to stop him saying, "His hair is Ethiopian hair. Why did you not get this boy an afro comb?" On 19th of April 1978, the social worker writes,
"There is a letter on file from Norman's mother, written in 1968, requesting that he be returned to her in Ethiopia. Perhaps Norman should be made aware of this."
And underneath, a handwritten comment,
"Not yet, I think."
The social worker's report continues,
"The Greenwoods are seen by Norman as his parents."
Why would the social worker say that? They told me they were my parents forever. Why would I think anything else? As with most brothers close in age, Christopher and I fought like snakes on each other's territory. Christopher always, even in the midst of thrills, betrayed a fretfulness. I had no idea that Mum thought it was my fault. We raced each other home from school every single day, and every single day I beat him. I waited in the kitchen by my mum. He dived into Mum's arms and said, "Mum, Mum, I beat Norman, didn't I?" She stroked his head, and then she looked at me. "Yes, you did." 1973. I've only two school reports from my infants and junior schools.
"Norman is a carefree and happy child and is an asset to the class. His lively personality makes him popular with the other children."
11th of July, 1978. My junior school report. I am 11 years old.
"Norman is an enthusiastic worker. He is cooperative and eager to please. Norman is a most likeable boy. A ray of sunshine."
12th of July, 1978, the social worker's response.
"Discussed Norman with Miss Jones, who has a quite pathetic attitude towards the child, purely based on his colour. See recent report where she refers to him as ray of sunshine. Hopefully the staff at his new school will be more realistic.
December 1978, the social worker reports that Mrs. Greenwood had a daughter. Her name was Helen. It was an unexpected pregnancy. The household now had 4 children and 2 adults. The social worker received a phone call on 13th of May 1979, 8 days before my 12th birthday.
Phone call from Mrs. Greenwood. A row with Norman had resulted in him threatening to kill all members of the family, except baby Helen. Mrs. Greenwood had reacted by packing him off to her mother's visit, and Mrs. Greenwood very upset. The row had developed from Norman badgering Chris to loan him his cricket stumps. Mrs. Greenwood had advised Chris not to loan them, as Norman is extremely careless with equipment. Norman had told Chris that the decision was his and not their mum's. Mrs. Greenwood lost her temper and told him to leave.
Home was hell. I couldn't do anything right. The better I did, the worse I was treated. I was deceitful. I was tricking everyone into thinking I was a good kid. For the life of me, I didn't understand. On 16th of June 1979, a visit from the social worker.
Some 10 minutes with Norman on his own. The incident had clearly shaken Norman. He admitted to difficulties of controlling his temper, but insisted that he had not meant what he said. He did recognise that his mum was under strain, although he didn't know why, told him some of the reasons, and his response was, "If only I had realised."
I didn't threaten to murder the family. Full disclosure, I probably said to my brother, "I'm going to kill you." Brothers say things like that in the heat of the moment. The following report by my new social worker is from 2nd of November 1979.
Mrs. Greenwood told me that they had been to a parents' evening at school last night and that there had been very unfavourable reports about Norman. She says that she sometimes thinks Norman is amoral. She told me that he smokes, swears, steals, and he seems to harbour a grudge about being black. She said that she was at the end of her tether.
The only report from my high school is from the summer of 1979.
Well behaved in lessons. Always keen to please and has many friends. Norman has settled down well in his first year.
I felt like I'd done everything to show them that I love them. And I'd done everything to show God that I loved God. And they were still my parents forever. Right? On 1st of December 1979, the report records that Mrs. Greenwood called the social worker to take me away. He writes,
"Spoke to foster parents on telephone. Both almost insisted that Norman had to leave today. I explained that we should discuss this. Arranged to see them on the 2nd of January 1980 with a provisional place in Woodfield arranged."
Norman Mills, my social worker, has since told me that he informed the foster parents that having made a commitment to me as their parents, it was not right for them to demand I be taken away. So I didn't go. It was the end of December 1979, and I was excited when I entered the front room for the family meeting because it was just me and Mum and Dad. I sat at the table and my Mum looked at me intensely. "You don't love us, do you?" I said, "Yes, I do love you. We want you to spend the next day thinking about love and what it is. Read the scriptures and give us your most honest and truthful answer tomorrow." That was it. It was a clear instruction from Mum and Dad. I prayed to God and I read the Bible to see if a passage would answer the question. They wanted me to ask God for forgiveness, and through him I would learn to love them. And in the Baptist faith, a sinner must ask forgiveness for his sins. The theology was perfect, the timing unquestionable, and the answer as honest as a sinner could get. The next day came, and I said it with pride, because I thought I had found the answer that they wanted. "I mustn't love you," I said. I looked at their faces to see if I had said the right thing. "But I will ask God for forgiveness, and I'll learn to love you." This was the perfect answer. "Seek and ye shall find." My mum looked at me as if I had wounded her. "You don't love us? You don't want to be with us?" All of this happened the day after they had made a call to the social worker who reports.
31st of December 1979. Message left after Christmas saying the Greenwoods wanted Norman removed without further discussion.
My mum wouldn't hug me as I left. So I hugged her. Norman Mills, my new social worker, ushered me gently into the car. The car filled with a quiet loss. Mum told me they would never visit me because it was my choice to leave them because I didn't love them. This was the beginning of empty Christmas times and hollow birthdays. This was the beginning of not being touched. I'm 12. I said to Norman Mills in the car, "I know this is my fault and I will ask God for forgiveness." He pulled the car quietly into a lay-by and turned the engine off. "None of this is your fault." I had no idea what he meant. If it wasn't my fault, why could I never return home? Night can't drive out night. Only the light above. Fear can't drive out fear. Only love. My 12-year-old self stood still between two doors in the hall. 2 feet in front of me, the clenched fists of the banisters to a grand staircase, bigger than I'd ever seen. My heart wanted to jump out of my chest and run away back to the Greenwood so that I could tell them all about it. I didn't lean on the wall. My arms were by my side, my shoulders back. I stood like I'd been taught a good boy should stand. Hands out of pockets. Best behaviour. A boy appeared from nowhere. He was shuddering with excitement. "So who da-da-da-da-da are you?" He fired questions at me, none of which I could answer. His name was Jack. "Hello, I'm Norman," I said and stuck out my hand for him to shake. "How do you do?" Jack stared at my outstretched hand as if I was an alien. He craned his head to the side with a bemused look. He raised both hands and twisted my ears and ran off, whooping with laughter. I was still reeling when I heard the steps of adults. Norman Mills was with Mr. John Harding, a beer-bellied Manchester City supporter. He ran Woodfield's Children's Home. He showed me the dining room and kitchen. The cook switched on the industrial potato peeler. It filled the kitchen with the rumble of thunder. The steel teapot was twice the size of my head. The cellar was daunting. A low ceiling was lined with flickering strip lights. There was a room just a little bit bigger than the table tennis table that squeezed into it. Then the laundrette with industrial steam presses for the bed sheets, and a long walkway with benches and rows of shoes. There'd be many times in the future that I would play table tennis with myself by pushing the table against the wall. Backhand and forehand smash, defend and attack, spin, cut, lob, slice. My body would skip around the table and I'd narrate the game against Christopher, my invisible brother, and I'd let him win. All my personal belongings went in the locker by the bed. I asked when my clothes and toys would be arriving. They were in the trunk back at home, the one with my name on it, the one Grandad Munro made. But nothing was coming from there, not even a Bible. I had nothing to put in the locker. Over the next few weeks, the children's home filled with mainly teenagers. Most children in care have someone they can call family. I had no one. Peter Libby was my first friend. He was half Chinese, half English. He was a year older than me. Libby, took one look at me and with a big smile he pronounced in a broadly accent, "Right, Chalky White, that's you." And from then on, Chalky White was my nickname. I loved it. Libby introduced me to the new world. He wasn't necessarily the hardest guy in the home, but he was the funniest. Libby was highly intelligent, like the Artful Dodger. By calling me Chalky, my mate, he was shoring up against what he knew would be a tirade of unbridled racism. If I couldn't take a joke, I would be in for a rough ride. I'll never be able to thank him enough for what lay beneath this christening. Eventually, I came to hate the nickname Chalky White. But I can see now what Libby was doing. There were three huge boys' dormitories on one side of the landing, between 4 and 7 of us per bedroom. I hardly slept for the first month. The sheets were stiff and forbidding. The blankets were scratchy. On 4th of January 1980, the social worker reports,
"Saw Norman at Woodfields. He's insistent he wants to remain at Birchall High School. I'm aware that the Greenwoods do not want him to continue there as they feel it would cause problems for their son, Christopher. 18th of January 1980. Norman's very unhappy about the prospect of attending Lee CE Secondary. Still wanting to see Greenwood family ASAP. Norman, however, embarrassed about going home. I offered to make arrangements for a Saturday visit. 26th of January 1980. Norman escorted to foster home. Welcome for him kept on a low key and noticeable that the two older children nowhere to be seen. Greenwoods took Norman back to the children's home, but would not go to the door.
Norman Mills.